Listener production.
Shares.
Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that also didn't put interest rates up this week. I'm Scott Phillips from The Motley Fool. He is the straw man himself, Andrew Page Esquire. Mr. Page, g'day.
G'day, g'day. How are you?
I'm very, very well. How are you?
Very good. Very good.
Now, I should say you are from strawman.com. Australia's premier online investment club. It's one of our correspondents. You say private online investment club, but he's gone with premier investment club. I reckon that's that could stick. You can use the same acronym and really amp it up a bit.
We're all about the velvet rope here at Strawman.
Yeah. It's all about the money. All about the dollar bills. Anyway.
Dollar bills, y'all.
Did you ever see the Ross Greenwood thing on that one?
No.
Not suitable for work, anyone who's watching and listening and thinking about that, but it's actually very, very funny.
Okay.
It's not suitable for work, but Greenwood.
I shall be Googling immediately after
this. You're welcome to do that. Moving on. They're always big weeks these days. Another big week in finance, investing, and economics. Plenty of stuff going on. Let's start with I think it is the big news for different reasons than usual. The Reserve Bank had its meeting this week, and they kept rates on hold. That is not news and not going to surprise anybody unless you've been under a rock and this is the only place you get your news from, in which case can I recommend some other places you might want to prefer to get your news from. But rates on hold, 4.35%. That was kind of a big deal, I suppose, and better than going out for those paying a mortgage. The difference, I think, was the way this was done. This is the first of the new style of RBA meetings. Not the new board yet. That's still to come. I think it might be July or September this year. That's still to come. But the current board is now meeting for 2 days rather than one.
Two half days,
correct. Instead of one half day, yeah. So 2 half days rather than one. They're only meeting 8 times this year rather than the usual 11. So that's new as well, 8 times. And Governor Michelle Bullock had a press conference and actually had to kind of stand up in front of the assorted media and give her thoughts on what has happened, what she thought, answer some questions of varying degrees of quality, let me say. We might get to that in a second.
Yes.
Did you watch it?
I started watching it, and then I started multitasking, which meant that I stopped paying attention to it.
I was watching on the computer, and the young bloke walked past. It was after school. He said, "Dad, what are you watching?" It's like the Reserve Bank decision. Said, "Why?" I said, "That's my job." He said, "Oh, okay." Wandered off. I wasn't impressed at all.
Sucks to be you, Dad.
Yeah, pretty much. You'd be watching YouTube, Dad. What are you watching this for? Sorry, you were going to say?
I was just going to say, I mean, the theatre of it is noteworthy. I don't know what I think about it. On one hand, that's what the US do. The Fed chairman has to front up and answer questions. I like the idea that it gives a platform for journalists on our behalf to clarify what might be in the minds of these very powerful institutions. So that's sort of like, it's hard to go against that. Mm. But the reason I zoned out is that they can't say anything.
Yeah, it was so. We're never going to. That's the other thing, right? All the journalists want is tell us about things you didn't write. Well, I didn't write them because I didn't want to say them. It's this really weird dance.
Do you know what stuck out for me was what everyone wants?
Yeah.
I think in a word, and it's understandable.
Yeah.
Is certainty.
Yeah.
We want certainty. So they tried to. Michelle did an astounding job.
She did.
I will say that
for someone who's not a press trainer, she's done some training, but she's an econocrat, right? She spends her life doing spreadsheets. And sometimes you got to stand up in front of trained journalists who ordinarily would be giving elbow curry. Yep. And answer their question like, man, that's freaky in the first place. But go on, she did it right.
And they wanted the gotchas. They wanted the, can you rule in or rule out? It's just like, oh, God, seriously, is this the state? Yes, this is the state of journalism in this country. And it's understandable, right? So what are you going to do? What are you going to do? So I was actually on Channel 7 the other night. Okay. And shout out to Ange Cox here. She's a legend. And she's a fan of the podcast too, which is how it all happened. Okay. Special shout out to Ange. And,
nice.
So we had a great chat. And anyway, the point that I was sort of making was that this melts my brain a little bit, is that one of the important tools that the RBA has is the jawbone. We've spoken about this before.
Yep.
And this is the idea that the what central bankers say is almost as important as the actual policy settings themselves.
Yes, particularly about the future. They get to kind of say, well, we might have to do this, or we were thinking about that. It's all the stuff they didn't quite do or might do in the future if we don't take the, if we don't get the message, right?
One day we'll do a drinking, the next time, it's probably a bit early in the day, but the next time it's on, we'll do a drinking game. And every time she says, on the other hand, we have to take a drink, right? Because we'll be under the table within like 5 minutes.
Correct.
Because everyone's like, what can you do? Is this going to happen? Is that not going to happen? Now, let's say, this is going to sound conspiratorial. It's not. But let's say that they're behind closed doors. They're thinking, actually, I think inflation is, you know, it's still a bit higher than what we like, but it's trending in the right direction. We're comfortable with that. Unemployment is still really low. You know, I think we're in a good position to maybe start cutting rates in the near future. She can't say that, though, because if she says that, as soon as that is said, it is taken as read. And it's as if it was already cut. Exhibit A, Philip Lowe saying that rates, well, again, he was taken a little bit out of context to be fair to Phil, but what people heard was rates aren't going anywhere for 2024. Yep. So what did people do? People acted as if that was fact and then were upset when it happens. What?
I don't even reckon they did, mate.
No?
I've never heard someone who said, I wasn't going to buy a house, but I did because the RBA said rate to be lower for another year. I honestly think this is all after the fact, where it's like, now it hurts. And that bad man said it wouldn't hurt this much. I don't reckon maybe 14 people in the country did something specifically because Phil said it'd be staying low. I reckon everyone's gone, I did it anyway. I was going to do it anyway.
Yeah,
and it didn't go up. So now I'm really annoyed that I'm paying more interest. It's like, I reckon, I said, you count on two hands and maybe 1 foot. The number of people actually went, I was going to do it, but Phil said I should. So now I'm going to.
I think that's fair. However, let's like play it through. If Ms. Bullock had gone up and said that, we're really expecting to cut rates in the near term.
Yeah.
Markets would price that very quickly. Banks would take that as red. Borrowers would take that as red. And you're right. Maybe that people were going to do whatever they were going to do anyway. But I bet you the market would have rallied on the back of that news because, remember, nothing, they've come out and said it's on hold. We're not changing anything. Yeah. The settings, our hands are, we've backed away from the console. We're not twiddling the dials. but that jawbone has had a really potent and real impact.
Yeah.
And that is why I think she was pretty guarded, and the answers are always the same. Mm. We don't know.
Yeah,
we think this.
Correct.
If this happens, then maybe that. If not, no.
Yeah,
we'll be driven by the data. Now I could take that answer and I can cut and paste that on pretty much on after any correct. Meeting.
Exactly.
And it was funny on Twitter. You see people who are expecting. Have a certain view on what rates are going to do this year, using that as, you know, exhibit A as to why they were right. Yeah, and people who have the opposite view, using it as exhibit A as to why they are right. And this is why I say there's so much theater to this, you know, the priest has, you know, ascended the mount and said something. We are all like looking at through the entrails and, you know, analyzing every word. It is, I find it mad, frankly.
Yeah, it is crazy, mate. One of the journos actually literally asked her, on a scale of 1 to 10, what number would you give for your confidence level in your forecast?
Five.
That was the great thing about it. Michelle Ball's gone, well, it's a mid-range forecast, so 5. That's the point.
Yeah.
Which is a perfect econocrat's answer, which, you know, it was supposed to be this kind of, you know, you're not giving me a yes or no, but maybe if I ask you for a scale, you'll do it. It's like, no, Michelle Bullock's all over this one. She knows what the midpoint of the forecast is, the 50th percentile. That's why it's the midpoint. That's easy, you know?
So this is where I come back to answer your question. Like, is it a good or bad thing to have this meeting? It's like, well, in theory, it's a good thing. In practice, it's just more for the circus. I don't think what actually comes out of it. I don't know if I was better informed afterwards than I would have been with just a simple statement.
No, I agree. And that's my look. You know, they say never have an argument with someone who buys ink by the barrel. In other words, don't argue with a journalist or a newspaper proprietor. And, you know, the media want to be able to ask the questions. And, you know, they were all there and go, so I'm so-and-so from this outlet, so I was there and doing my thing. And that's fine. And, you know, there's some good people there asking questions on behalf of their audience. But The simple reality is the RBA has said what they're going to say. There is no need for it. At best, what they end up getting is Michelle Bullock misspeaking and getting a gotcha, because that's the only thing that's going to come out of that. The only way there was a headline out of that press conference was if she screwed up.
Yeah.
And so basically, it's not about more color or more flavor or more anything else. It's just, if I ask you enough questions, if I do it often enough, can I finally get a gotcha at some point?
That's which is the reality TV angle, right? It's the Real Housewives angle. It's like the tabloid. Oh, look, you know, look what she did. She fell flat in her face, and we all cheer and ha ha ha.
And a bit of what would you tell people of Australia about this? Yeah. Like, you know, it's all. I will say, I'm going to give myself a rap actually, because you know we like confirmation bias. You said
absolutely.
The two best questions by length of the straight were by two people I've had on the Good Oil podcast. So give them a rap and give myself a rap for good judgment, because I've already had them on. They've been their episodes have aired. Michael Pascoe and Jenny Duke asked excellent questions. I thought they were, in terms of, you know, the implications of it. And this was the difference is, you know, you want to say, well, what did you really think? Well, I've told you what I really think. It's in the numbers. If you're going to ask questions for clarity, if you want more information, then you say either, this wasn't in the numbers or wasn't in the data. What does it say about this thing? What does that mean for this thing? And Jenny Duke and Michael Pascoe both asked really, really good questions. So give them
what were the questions?
I'm trying to remember Jenny's actually. Michael Pascoe's was about full employment.
Okay.
And his point was...
Oh, that was excellent.
You wrote an article about it subsequently, but he basically... Yeah. He was the guy, by the way, who asked Phil Lowe if we're in a technical per capita recession. At National Press Club. Again, the best question at the National Press Club.
Yeah.
There's something to be said for grey hair. Pascoe's a gun.
By the way, very, very quick aside, we are in big trouble when a lot of these veterans retire. I don't know if the new so apologies to the younger financial journalists out there, but you know, the likes of Ross Gittins and Pascoe and et cetera, when they get the gold watch and retire. I feel as though we're going to be much less informed as a nation.
I will say, so the New Daily as a newspaper, whatever it is, news site these days, owned by the superannuation funds, and so it gets a lot of grief about being this lefty union-backed thing, whatever. I have very little time and interest in that, as you know. But it's got people like Pascoe, who's just writing a column, basically because he wants to.
Yeah.
I'm sure he's getting paid for it. I'm sure he likes getting paid for it, but... Pascoe could happily just say on the sunset, but he's got something to say and he's got some value. Alan Cole is doing the same. His best stuff has been on the New Daily as well. It's just a platform. You know, we'll pay you if they pay him a week. I'm sure they do it for nothing. You know, to write a column which is insightful and thoughtful and as a result of your X years of experience, and it's just really good. I share your concern, actually, mate, just as a quick tangent about those veterans who are potentially at some point, well, officially will leave. I'm still not sure Ross Gittins isn't immortal. I'm holding on to that one, like Warren Buffett. They're in my immortals list.
Yeah, but I'm such a fanboy, by the way. You got to get him on the pod. He's outstanding.
I just quietly
been trying.
If you don't get in touch with Ross, please do for me, because I've sent him an email. I've got absolute donuts. So if you do know Ross, please send him my way. You're right. I guess once upon a time, Pascoe and Gittins and Cola were the Young Turks. So maybe we shouldn't be too worried. Hopefully there'll be someone coming up. So just quickly, Ross Gittins on the 7th, so it was this Wednesday just gone, celebrated his 50th anniversary of writing at the Herald, which is just amazing.
It's brilliant.
And there's a lot of stuff written about him.
And still as sharp as ever. What my economics teacher in year 10, and I don't want to date myself too much, was a long time. it was pre-internet, right? But we had to... It was such a formative experience, because part of that year was you have to read Ross Gittins. Not you have to read the finance section of the Herald or whatever. No, you have to read Ross
specifically.
Gittins.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and it was just like it was one of the best things a teacher's ever done, really. Yep. And I'll say this very quickly with Ross and Michael is that I don't believe they're formally trained economists, and.
I'm not sure about Pascoe, but Ross certainly isn't.
Ross isn't. And I actually think that gives you no disrespect to those that are trained in it, but I feel as though they come at it without preconceived judgments. Yeah. And they have sort of, like all of us, gone, well, how does that work?
Yeah.
And they've gone off and sort of just picked at that until they've gotten a what they feel is a good sort of understanding. And I just feel as though I would take those two's opinion on the economy over most of the, in fact, all of the senior bank economists and most of the other ones, frankly. And I think they just get far better takes and understand what the economy is and how it works better than a lot of other people.
Yeah, I think it's a really, really good point.
So if he doesn't come onto your podcast after that gushing praise, like,
that's right, Ross. Come on,
come on.
Anyway, so really, really quickly, there's a whole lot of articles I've tweeted about it too. Jump on that about Ross's 50th kind of anniversary at the Herald and all that kind of stuff. And he in that article he talks about mentoring about, you know, maybe a dozen or 15 different junior economics journos, and hopefully they kind of, you know, benefit from that and go on to achieve great things like Ross has. But you're right about that concern. Winding it all the way back to the RBA. By the way, you asked about Pascoe's question. It was about unemployment and basically asking, you know, what is full employment? Will we ever know it? Are we already past that point? And it was the one time Michelle Bullock actually looked rattled. And again, it was because she knew the questions to expect, right? From the usual ones was, what do you say about interest rates? What about this? Why isn't it up? What's your forecast? And Pascoe's gone, well, what does that mean for full employment then?
Yeah.
And she just wasn't ready for the question, which is, again, not a criticism of her. And it wasn't a gotcha question. It was a genuine, hey, where are we then? What does this mean? What does the RBA think about full employment? Remembering, of course, it used to be 4.5% was the kind of generally accepted number. And now under 4, we're kind of saying, well, hang on, I don't know anymore. What is it? Where does it sit? You know, and that's
Wasn't that answer very telling? I thought it was very telling.
Tell us why.
She basically said, I'll paraphrase, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. We used to have this, what was it? Non-accelerating rate of unemployment. I forget the acronym.
Non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment. NIRU.
Right.
Yeah.
So you want the full employment is defined as that level of employment which doesn't lead to, doesn't have inflationary impacts.
Correct.
So it's not, you know, it's, what's that? Well, it depends what model you want to use and what assumptions you want to plug into it.
And we don't know because by the time it gets there, it's hard to tell. Yeah.
It's like they might as well have gotten up and said, hey, Michelle, what is love? And I'm like,
baby, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me no more. Yeah.
You know, instead of like, well, like, I guess we've got a sense of what it means, but how do I define that? And it just goes to show you, and this is not being critical of her or the board or anything in any way, but we want certainty. We want these hard data points, and they're not there. Certainty doesn't exist. And even when you look at the framework which is in which they operate, they don't really have clear definitions for these things. And I find that very telling. And yet, okay, so you go, okay, fair enough. Like, how, you know, what is love? How can you define it, right? And yet, they have forecasts for this thing and where they think they would like it to be.
Yeah.
So it's like, hey, Scott, what's the kind of unemployment rate that we need? Oh, we don't know. I can't give you that number. Okay, cool. So what's your plan? Well, we want to get unemployment to this rate because we think that's going to be the right setting. Mm-hmm. Like, but you just, sorry, didn't you just say you don't know?
Exactly.
Like, square that circle for me. Yes. And that's why I say it's telling that it's just, I think it was a little bit of a peek behind the veil here. It's like, you know, we all suffer from imposter syndrome. I'm sure late at night, all the very senior members of the RBA board go, oh my gosh, please no one discover me for the, not I want to say fraud, fake it till you make it. Right. And 100%. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm being cynical.
You're right. I think, well, you know what, it's also one of those things that, so what I actually think she should have owned the answer, honestly, rather than sheepishly answering it and kind of scurrying off, which is kind of what she did because she was a bit rattled. And I don't blame her. She's an econocrat. I've said a million times. I really genuinely feel sorry for Lowe and for Michelle Bullock. They're not trained in this stuff. You know, the head of most CEOs of most companies are the head salesperson one way or the other, right? Because they've got that skill. They're appointed for that reason. Reserve Bank governors, you kind of don't want. Ideally, you don't really want the polished performer because you're trading off something else. If you've got two perfectly identical candidates and one happens to be great with the media, excellent. Mm-hmm. If you start to say, oh, look, the next one's not quite as good as this other candidate, but they talk well and they've got a nice smile, it's like, oh, that's a slippery slope, right? So you kind of don't want them to do that. On the other hand, the gotcha kind of politics we have at the moment is also pretty ugly. So
yeah.
She should have owned it and said, we actually don't know. Because that is the reality. That's the reality of economics, right? That thing of, we're all guessing. We're trying to apply educated guesswork based on like a lifetime of study and a whole lot of experience and evidence and stuff. And there's things we know and things we don't know and things we kind of know directionally or roughly that kind of tend to play out more often than not. And that's okay too. Yeah. You know, what's full employment? I don't know. How low does unemployment get before it pushes wages up? Well, We don't know, but you know, we're going to probably find out if things stay low at the moment. Mm. That, it's all that stuff that we just kind of assumed. And we're learning that maybe when you get below that level, actually we were wrong. And so we recalibrate. I think that's okay. I think I'd almost, she said so many times, this is our forecast on one hand, the other hand. She could have just literally said, we're not sure. No one's ever sure.
Shoulder shrug.
We're in new territory. No. 40 years later, you know, 40 years since we've been this level, we can't know. We haven't been here. Well, we're finding out. Good question, Michael. That would have been the right answer, right? Rather than kind of feeling like it was, she should have known, and because she didn't, it was a problem. I think that's, and that's, you know, there is that, you know, post syndrome is one side of it. The other side is that, I don't say arrogance because I certainly don't want to apply it to Michelle Bullock, but that idea of, I think I should know the answer. If I don't know the answers, that's a problem. As opposed to, there's lots of stuff we don't know. And saying, I don't know, is a really, really powerful answer. You and I do it all the time with predictions and forecasts and share prices and even companies. I don't know, but I think this.
Oh, for anyone listening, I think it's a superpower, not because we're anything special, but like,
well, we are.
It's just anyone out there in any field or any domain, those are the three most powerful words in the world, is to say, I don't know when you don't know. It's because if you don't know and you pretend that you do, bad stuff can happen. Yeah, anyway, continue.
Solid point. No, that was about it. Look, so the press conference, I think it's a waste of time. Again, great question from those two. Even then, you know, I like is the stuff that the RBA hasn't talked about. There's stuff they're not going to say because they haven't put it in the thing because they haven't said it. If there's something that's not in the statement, then that's where you add value, because you add to the breadth of the commentary rather than trying to nail into one thing and say, you didn't say this, can you say it now? It's like, no, I didn't say it on purpose. I'm not going to say it now. What are you, stupid? As opposed to, actually, you haven't talked about NAIRU or the full employment for a while. Can we talk about that? You know, that's where you actually add to what was written. I think that's really, really useful.
Yes.
So, man, hopefully it improves. First, and by the way, first time out for everyone, including the journos. So, eventually they're going to stop asking those questions because Michelle Bullock's going to answer them the same way. And they're going to have to move on to something else and say, okay, well, what about this then? I think that's probably, you know, maybe it evolves over time. I think I've said before, I don't love 8 meetings rather than 11. In a 24/7 world, waiting 6 weeks between meetings rather than 4 weeks, is it a big deal? Probably not. But on the other hand, think about the rate hiking cycle we had more recently. Mm. If we'd have had 8 meetings, they would have had to raise it in larger chunks less often.
Yep.
And I don't think that's ever a good idea. smooth is always better than jerky. Go on.
Can they, I believe they can. Can they have a quote unquote emergency meeting? So
I don't know for sure, but I'm 1,000,000% sure they can.
Like, so something real went down. They could just like, okay, we're not due for a meeting, but we'll have a meeting.
Yeah, I'm sure they can. But it's one of those things where you kind of think, you know, in this world, you know, less action is good if your job is not to take action, but that's kind of is their job. You know, if you're investing less often is great. You know, worrying less often about the ups and downs is great. If there's genuinely something happening, you know, you're right. If there's a big dislocation, they'll meet. But one of those, you know, again, if you cast your mind back to the last 2 years and say, if they'd only had 8 meetings, what would happen at each meeting? The answer would have been we would have had less frequent, larger jumps. And I don't know, the impact on consumer confidence, business confidence in both directions on that one is like, you know, each meeting now becomes like, maybe it's going to be 0.5% rather than a quarter. It just changes dynamics. So I'd rather do it more often. I don't mind the 2-day meeting. I don't know what happens inside that room. Michelle Bullock said there was more time for conversation, but she would say that because the treasurer said he wanted it, so she did it. So what else do you say?
I'm pretty sure what happens in that room is from that South Park clip where there's that they get a chicken and chop its head off and it runs around a board that has different decisions on it, and wherever the body lands while someone plays a kazoo.
I have not seen that, but
that's another thing to YouTube look up.
South Park and anyway, Ross Greenwood. Hey, really massive tangent.
Before you do, I don't know. Well, are you? I don't want to move on from RBA stuff just yet. But the other thing that I think is very interesting is that and this is what Pascal was talking about, I think, in his article, was the making common of the lag effects.
Yes.
So we've gone through the fastest rate tightening cycle in history. Mm-hmm. And as you've made the comment, others have made the comment, you know, inflation really trending sort of down. If you sort of look at it on a run rate basis, it's like kind of very close to job done. Mm. And it's this idea of steering a container ship while only looking backwards, right?
Yeah, that's right.
By the time you see ice in your wake and you crank the wheel hard to port or starboard or whichever direction you're going, again, I'm going to get flummoxed by my nautical terms here. it's going to take like up to a year. And don't forget, we're only still a partway through this. It's a bit of a hackneyed term, but the mortgage cliff.
That's correct.
At this point in time as well. So it will be a – like. Well, I've got to be careful here. If it turns out that the increases were too aggressive, we actually don't really – we don't really – I don't think we can definitively say whether that is true or not yet because of that lag effect. And then if that is the case, they will need to react very quickly on the other side of that. So I don't know. I just thought – I wanted to raise that because I was keen to get your thoughts on that part of it.
I think you're right. I've said a lot over the last 2 years probably. The last RBA rate rise will be one too many because it always is.
Yep.
And so I think the only exception I had to Pascoe's article, again, I'm a massive Pascoe fan, was the expectation that they wouldn't get it wrong almost. You know, if you think about what's going to happen, the RBA is always going to be wrong. They waited too long to put rates up. I mean, maybe they're right sometimes. But again, because the future is unknowable, to your very point, you're not going to know whether you've under or overshot until it's too late.
Yep.
And so when you're at a tightening bias, in other words, when you're increasing rates, you're probably going to go too far. When you're lowering rates, like they did, they're probably going to go too far because you're so desperately trying to avoid the thing that's the clear and present danger now. Given their druthers, they're going to say, well, what do I want to do? Do I want to almost fix inflation or do I want to overfix it? And generally speaking, it's not. I don't even think it's unreasonable. If you had a choice, if I said to you, mate, you can do two things. You can err on the side of maybe, you know, foot on the throat, almost over. You let him get back up and run away, or you say, I'm going to absolutely make sure this thing's dead. Mm. You know, you probably, I would anyway. I don't know about you. You may have a different view, but I'm going to make sure it's dead. Mm. So I'm probably going to over tighten, right? And then I'm going to have to respond. I guess my point is just to Pascoe's point was he's absolutely right. But I think that's not exactly it's a feature, not a bug. It's not a feature. We don't want it. But it's kind of like it's kind of just what happens. It almost always is the case that we go one too many in either direction all the time because that's just the nature of people and the nature of the challenges we're trying to fix. When we're trying to stimulate the economy to make sure it doesn't hit recession, we're probably going to overstimulate because we're desperately trying to keep it out of recession. When you're tightening to try and kill inflation, you're probably going to over-tighten to make sure you kill inflation. It's kind of almost inherent in the job. So I don't know. I in a perfect world, of course, you would do exactly right each time. But given those lag effects, I don't know. I'm not. Hindsight's always 20/22, right? Like you always look back and say, well, obviously they did the wrong thing there. They should have done this. It's like, yeah, but the counterfactual you don't get to see. And if they hadn't done it, what would have happened? You know, people say, well, the government's COVID spending was too much. Look where we are now. It's like, yes, but what if we hadn't done it? What would happen then? Well, I don't know, but they've done the wrong thing now. It's like, yeah. And so I'm always a little bit slow to blame the Reserve Bank or I blame the government plenty. But in that kind of case, I've said about the Morrison COVID support, it was big, fast and ugly, was exactly what it needed to be. Because you didn't have time for fine tuning the first time around. Second time around, they should have fixed some of the errors. But first time around out of the gate, it's like, we've got a week to sort this out. What do we do? I don't know. Let's do these three things and make sure it happens. Okay, cool. Let's do that. So I don't know. I try and be a little bit generous with the uncertainty that happens at the time that in hindsight is seemingly 2020 and easy to look at and go, oh, obviously they made those mistakes. Yeah. I don't know. Am I being too generous?
Not towards the people, but just the setup, I guess is my, I feel as though we put people who ostensibly are honest, capable, well-meaning people in control of things that we shouldn't expect anyone to ever
that's right.
Be able, you know, because it is too hard. It is way too hard.
Yeah.
It's like having a commissioner for the roulette wheel and who has to like give a prediction on where the ball's going to land. It's like, well, that's a mug's game. Why am I? You know, I don't want that job. I'm always going to have mud on my face. And is it the person dumb, bad, evil for getting it wrong, or have we just asked too much of them?
It's inherent in the task. Exactly.
The system. It's an impossible system, which is where we get into our fundamental ideological kind of divides here. So let's not go down that path. But I guess that'd be my take.
No, that's fair. Hey, I want to pick that up. This is a beautiful segue, actually, because that was on Tuesday. I think also on Tuesday, it might have been Monday. I think it was Tuesday. Nick Scali and Meyer both reported their earnings, and for all of the inflation's obviously dead, it's going the right way. We're getting there already. Things are going to happen really quickly. There was a little moment of pause for me when these numbers came out. Myer's same store sales were the same for the the first half of their financial year, so the second half of last year, as they were the year before. Nick Scali's were down 20%, but then up in January. And it kind of makes you, you know, again, notwithstanding our ideological differences on what we should try and or not try to do, there's you know, if inflation's dead or almost dead, there was a sense of, are we so sure it's not stirring? You know, Nick Scali is probably the ultimate discretionary retail. Their sales were down 20% in the second half of last year compared to the year before, right? So massive fall, like just catastrophic drop in sales. But then in January, they rose again. Now, there is a year-on-year, there's a comparable, a base effect, if you like. If you start low, it's hard not to go higher. Mm. On the other hand, the declines we saw throughout the second half of last calendar year have reversed to be gains again. Mm. And you kind of look at that and go, ooh, I really, really hope this isn't a sign that maybe, you know, the RBA hasn't done quite enough, or that inflation isn't quite dead, or that demand isn't quite as subdued as it needs to be. But let's take the RBA out of it. The demand isn't quite as subdued as it needs to be to actually see inflation off. Then maybe there is, if not a second surge, at least some sense that there's signs of recovery or growth or something. And again, for Nick Scali shareholders, very happy for you. For my shareholders, those shares jumped as well, so I'm happy for both of you. But I don't know, mate. Am I being too worried when you get discretionary retail sales growing with rates at 4.35%?
I struggle with it too. I think we need to always be careful with general economic data points and company results. Is that there's a lot of shades of grey here.
Yeah,
and yeah. I just think Nick Scali, I would class as one of the best retailers on the ASX and in the country. It's up there with JB Hi-Fi and Bunnings. Like, just, and I say that with objective on my side. Yeah. They have grown their earnings at some unbelievable rate over a very, very long period of time.
Yeah.
But anyone who's been to a Nick Scali store or has a Nick Scali product, now, these are very high-end quality products. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not for the uber rich, but it's, you know, it's not fantastic furniture. You know, and that's not have a going at fantastic furniture. I think as a retailer, you need to know your niche. Mm. And so the kind of people who are buying the custom made leather couch, I would suspect are more able to be resilient in the face of economic uncertainty. Mm. And so I think what do we interpret from these results? I think we can make an interpretation on the client set that a Nick Scali would have, but we must be careful not to extend that to the entire economy. You know, sales are up 20%. Like, well, yeah, I'm pretty sure the bottom 40% socioeconomic group are not buying the new leather couch. I'm sure they are probably doing it as tough as they have ever done. So that it's that bifurcation kind of idea that I have with the economy is you've got to be careful with this stuff. I noticed the other day too, in some of the big European and US luxury brands are just on fire. Like, they're just doing so incredibly well. And again, that's because there is the haves and the haves nots, and they are very different markets and economies. So I guess that's the nuance that I would sort of say. The interesting thing is between Nick and Myers is that they're both at a PE of 10. You know, Nick Scali has grown its per share earnings from 21 cents in 2015 to $1.25 last year. Myers has gone from 12 cents to 9 cents over that period. You know, one is a really well-run company. The other's experiencing very difficult structural changes and maybe poor historical decision-making. That's the thing that surprises me is that, you know, with investors out there with the luxury of choice, and if you want to go to retail, it's like, well, people are actually saying that they're both worth the same relative to their earnings. Like, I know where my money would go if I had to choose between those two. That's all I'm saying.
I think that's right. I want to go back to your first point if I can, mate, because I've seen that response before. Obviously, it's the boomers, you know, boomers going to boom. Someone said on Twitter, which is all very nice and funny. And I don't know. I'm so over the generation war stuff. It drives me a little bit nuts. Anyway, I hear that, except that sales were down 20% last year.
Mm.
And then now they're growing again. And maybe it is. Maybe Scully's washed out all of the X's and the Z's and whatever comes after that, the double A's and A's and A's, if you're a concert goer. you know, maybe that was washed out. Maybe that's all that's left. And so then they're growing from that base for that reason. But it just struck me that there is growth. You know, if we'd said, well, Scully's isn't down at all because it's all boomers. Okay, fair enough. If they'd sailed through with no sales decline last year, we'd be like, yeah, of course. But there was $1.05 of sales disappeared, which shows they are exposed meaningfully, I think, to economic circumstances. Mm. And that's why I don't know that we can apply that view of, well, obviously the sales are growing because they've got boomer customers who aren't impacted by rates. Because if that was true, it wouldn't have happened. Excuse me, there wouldn't have been a sales decline last year. So that's why I'm just a little bit. I'm a little bit nervous. Probably too. I'm watchful. I'm mindful that there's something going on here. Something has changed between the end of last year and the beginning of this calendar year, and I don't know what that is yet. But I am, you know, the part of me that hopes. I don't want rates to go up, and maybe rates have already gone up too far to your and Pascoe's point. But if inflation doesn't come down, if it has kind of got a second wind, there might still be more work to do this year. I don't think we should assume necessarily that the game is over, the race is won, and cue George Bush and mission accomplished on the aircraft carrier. We want to be a little bit careful with that, I think. Maybe I'm just being too nervous, but just, yeah, it's interesting.
I mean, look you can take, two people can take the same data point and have the exact opposite interpretation, which I always find interesting and noteworthy, right? But there's, I feel as though if you're a Nick Scali shareholder, none of this is really new. If you've ever held shares for any meaningful period of time, this happened all the time, maybe not to the same kind of magnitude, but they have big swings in their sales. There is correct. A natural variability that is there, and it's not always predicated on very serious macro concerns. It's it just is, you know, my four holiday homes, the leather couches are in good condition, you know, until they're not, and then I'll replace them or whatever it is that people do there.
Yeah, yeah.
Can I just say just quietly too, Nick Scali, they talk about sales orders separately from revenues.
Oh, right.
And it's because they you go in, you look at the samples that are out there and say, I want that kind of couch, but I want this kind of fabric on it or whatever it is. They build to order. In other words, they don't have a bunch of inventory sitting around, which I think is a really cool business model.
Yeah, it's
right?
Great model, isn't it? Yeah.
So it's like, and that's why you say, I'm buying this couch. It's a reasonably expensive couch. I don't just whip around to the loading dock and drive home with it. It'll be delivered in 6 weeks because they're going to make it for you. And most people will be happy to wait for that. But it also means just from an inventory management standpoint, it gives them a lot more flex in their business model. Because imagine in that period where sales did drop 20%, they'd invested all this money in making couches that no one ultimately ended up needing, or fashions change, or it's just
so good.
I love that model. I just love that model. Yeah, I think it's a smart model. They are grade A retailers.
Yeah, correct. All right, let's go move on from there, mate. To something else that's been huge news this week is the workplace reform bill that at the time of recording, we're recording this on Thursday morning, the 8th of Feb. So give us some slack if we're getting this wrong. They haven't yet been proposed or been put to Parliament, and there's a lot of things going on in the background. So there's the same job, same pay stuff. Mm-hmm. There's the right to disconnect, which is kind of that something worth interesting. There's the right of a casual to request, and unless an employer's got a good reason not to be made permanent, to be put on the full-time roster rather than be a casual. Mm-hmm. Apparently hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages worth of legislation too. And the usual arguments, mate. Unions say this is necessary and important and worthwhile. The employers say it's costly and bureaucratic and unnecessary. A little bit hard to argue this one without having a philosophical, ideological perspective, because it does start with what do people deserve, what do businesses deserve, what's good for competition, what's good for people, employees. Yep. It's messy. All that said, we'll throw it at you and say, what do you make of it? How do you feel about what's going on?
It is so tricky, right? I think a good analog here is maybe the NDIS, right?
It's a whole other thing, yeah.
Is it? No, let's not go too far down the rabbit hole. But is it a good idea for there to be support for that part of the community. I think, yeah, absolutely. There, like, I'm very much in favor of it. And yet at the same time, I can say the execution and implementation and framework is an absolute nightmare. I know you've tweeted about that recently.
Oh, mate, just
bang on the money.
Debacle, yeah.
Show me the incentive, I'll show you the outcome. And the incentives are so misaligned with what the end goal should be. And the reason I raise that is that ideologically, and it's hard not to sort of comment on this without revealing a bit of your ideology, but I mean, I think a lot of these things, when you look at it, you think, well, yeah, maybe employees do have the right not to be called up at 9 o'clock at night from an overbearing boss. You know, I think that's pretty reasonable. But at the same time, is the way that implemented all that do is just make it much more costly, much more bureaucratic, you know, we're all worried about productivity. This does not help productivity. And the cynic in me goes, the reality is that they're just workarounds. So I technically can't do this, but I tell you what, look, mate, if you want this job, I need you to be able, pick up the phone. Now, if you don't want to do that, that's cool. That's cool, but you're not getting the job. And so what do you do? You go, no. In a market where the pendulum is swung in favor of workers and there's a million jobs that you can choose from, you know, maybe you've got a bit of a say. But in a situation where the employment market is tight and you don't have much choice, it's like, well, what are you going to do? Yeah. So it's sort of like, so now we're basically nothing changes except for the employer having this hassle to sort of deal with now and things getting clogged up in the court. So I can actually see, I can see the desire and in a lot of cases the need for it, but I can also, my worry is that the well-intentioned politicians can make things worse by implementing it in a poor fashion, I guess is where I stand. And I'm not saying they will implement it in a poor fashion, but that I think is a very real risk and it can be very counterproductive to the goals.
That's the bit I really struggle with, mate, because I think as much as a difference of opinion would be really helpful here because we'd argue with each other or discuss differently, I completely agree. I 100% agree. I think it's if the legislation, so it's got to be done. So firstly, there's a question about, is it relevant to your job or not? Mm. So, you know, I don't know. You've got to work that out. And then if it happens, it has to happen repeatedly. Mm-hmm. If it happens repeatedly, you have to discuss it with your boss first. Mm-hmm. And then if your boss doesn't do it, then you can take it to the Fair Work Commission. And the Fair Work Commission can then tell your boss to stop doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And then if that doesn't work, then the Fair Work Commission can fine the company.
Yep.
And that's, I think your point is right. This is,
just very quickly. Please. And by the way, if that is even halfway along that process, you are never getting a raise, right? You are.
It's over. Yeah.
You are over. And so you might have a moral victory in the courts, but your career at that institution is done.
Correct. And so, yeah, exactly. And by the time you get to that point anyway, the whole thing's probably so toxic.
Yes.
You know, there's the difference between a prohibition. You may not roster anyone on a Sunday without paying them time and a half. That's not a negotiation. That's just, in the award, whatever it is, right? That's the rule. That's the rule. So that's what you have to do.
Yep.
When it's like, well, it might be job-related and it has to be repeated, and then what's repeated and how frequently is okay. And by the time you get, as you say, by the time you get to that point, it's done. Now, on one hand, you know, there's two ways to look at it. You say, well, hang on, so the boss gets away with it because the employee's not going to complain because their career's screwed. So that's not good. True. But how else do you enforce it in a way that makes sense? If you're in a unionized workforce with a really regimented role, that can be written into enterprise bargaining agreements or something where it's like, you know, if you have a clerical class A position and you work for less than $45,000 a year, your boss may not contact you more than twice. That, you know, again, that stuff can be, it's a yes, no, this is what's in the rules. The boss knows the rules, the employee knows the rules. It's black and white, letter of the law stuff. Once you start to have this sort of discretion, I don't think the intent is bad at all, but I'm really, really not sure it's even close to doable in the law. Again, I think where this sort of stuff probably belongs is enterprise bargaining agreements for those sort of jobs.
Yeah.
Where you can say this is the way this has to work for this class of job with this person in this location. This is what's necessary. A generic right to disconnect. I mean, they do it overseas, a couple of countries, apparently France and it might be Germany, I think. But I just don't think it's workable, mate. I don't see how it's workable. And it's kind of the same, you know, I don't know. I tweeted as well, and I want to be careful because this gets political real fast, but both sides of politics tend to lose their way the same ways each time. Mm. Not same as each other, but the left loses its way the same way every time. The right loses its way the same way each time. Yeah. And it's, you know, take Howard's work choices, right? Just the overreach there.
Yeah.
That literally cost the election. On the other hand, the Labor Party tend to kind of over-bureaucratize stuff because bureaucracy is the answer for everything.
Yep.
It's kind of in the DNA. And, you know, I'm trying to be a pragmatist. Something in between there is probably, you know, competition, free competition regardless of regulation without rights is rubbish.
Yep.
Over-bureaucratizing something, so you have to read a 700-page document to try and understand the obligations, is also rubbish. I don't really even know what's in between. It's difficult.
Yeah. I mean, again, I really resonate with the intention here. You know, I think the people who have pushed for this have come at it because, particularly, I think there's a lot of exploitation in gig economy kind of jobs and the rest of it. And you look at it and you go, that's wrong. Someone should do something.
Yes.
I get the intention, right? And it's like, I don't know what the exact proper settings are, but I feel as though the more you try to control something, and the more specific you are, the more prone it is for the unintended consequence.
Anyway. Yeah, yeah.
You know, like the best remedy really is to have a very competitive marketplace.
Yeah.
This is always the answer. I always land on this. Whatever the problem is, it's like the more the invisible hand of the market can do its thing in an uninterrupted, non-crony capitalist kind of way.
Yeah, right.
The better it is. So what's the best way? Like if workers have a lot of option for employment, then employers have to offer really good conditions because they need to attract the right people.
Yeah.
If there's hardly any opportunity that's sort of out there because we've consolidated to very, very large mega corporations that hold all the power and have regulatory capture and all of these nasty sort of perversions of capitalism. And then it's kind of like, well, maybe then we do need some of these kinds of things in place to sort of counteract that. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
But even then, I'm saying, well, okay. Well, how do you make sure that happens?
Yeah,
I don't.
The reality is things like the minimum wage were required because even in 1900 and was it? I can't remember the Harvester decision for those who know that phrase, which set the minimum wage in Australia. There weren't big mega corporations. It was a very agricultural economy within theory. Hundreds of potential employers, and yet the market worked to a degree where the court found, I completely agree with it for what it's worth, maybe some don't, that left to its own devices, the market wasn't paying a living wage.
Yeah.
And so there was action required. 8-hour day, same sort of stuff. I'm far from a trade unionist, but some of those hard-fought wins early in the piece had to happen with collective action because the market in itself wasn't solving it. Now, some people will say, well, the union movement is part of the market, then the market loses all definition at some point. So, you know, but that collective action or the legislation sitting outside that was necessary. So you're right. I don't know. My sense is that fewer, bigger, more black and white rules are best. Thereafter, you kind of got to say, guys, I get it, but I kind of can't help you with that. You know, it's difficult.
Yeah. Again, because of the unintended consequences.
Yeah.
Just at the end of the day, you don't fix it. You make everything more complicated and productivity is worse than it was before.
And HR departments get bigger,
And government, we've now got another government department that needs to be funded, you know, and they only grow those things. And
another couple of hundred Fair Work Commission, requests or cases because you've got to try and legislate
And it's one thing to sort of pick on a Woolies or a Commonwealth Bank, these mega employers, you know, but the reality is that the majority of businesses are small businesses and that accounts for, in fact, the majority of GDP. And it's easy for someone like BHP who has a whole floor of an office to HR and the rest of it. It's another one for someone running a fish and chip shop. And you go, bloody hell, I've got to do what now? I mean, I'm desperately trying to keep my head above water here. I'm employing people, I'm creating value for society and yet you want me to do this now? It's like, oh, help me out here.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
So I've said this before. You've done this. You had a cafe at one point. I can't imagine I'm not going to do it, but if I was going to start a cafe tomorrow, between the planning regulations, when I can be open and closed, the workplace health and safety, the food standards, I can't so imagine hard. Trying to get my head around the number of things I would have to know and do just to open the door on day one. And then trying That's to keep across nightmare. Every change through everything over time. And again, those rules are there for reasonable. I'm not saying they should go away necessarily, but it's a massive impediment to innovation and new businesses because the guys who already there know it. The ones who are kind of starting, it's like the number of hoops I've got to jump through, I'm just not going to do it. I'll not bother. You know, and again, I'm not saying they should go away. We need food standards and we need workplace health and safety and we need, there's appropriate rules for these things. But just the number of them must be just mind-boggling, absolutely mind-boggling.
I'm going to say something and then, tomorrow I think, no, it's completely wrong. So I'm shooting a bit from the hip here. But I do wonder if it is better to have post-fact punitive measures rather than trying to prevent them from happening. Usually in most things, you'd say prevention is better than cure.
Yeah.
But if I wonder if what the solution is, at least in character, is you say, look, largely do what you like. But if you are found to have, broken these sort of guidelines, then there are very serious impacts. So now I don't need to sort of send... I don't have to have these huge bureaucracies and regulatory apparatus to sort of monitor and try and catch everything before it happens. But if it does happen, you're going to jail or you're suffering a big fine or your business is going to be, bankrupted or something. That is a very powerful incentive to do the right thing. And I don't need anyone looking over my shoulder from day to day. But it's easier for me to get away with things.
Yeah.
But if I am caught, I am toast.
As long as those things can be understood in advance.
Yeah.
You're not the gotcha rules where it's like there was 85 different rules. I missed the 71st because I just didn't know it existed or whatever. And so all of a sudden now I'm in the drink. But you're right. I think there is, speaking of getting in trouble, the term I really hate is wage theft.
Oh, yeah.
Not because I think it's wrong to thieve wages. Of course it is. But we apply it to things where, and take some of those big companies with 85 different awards that they've got, and someone's on the wrong award, or they've entered the wrong permutation of data in the system. Now, if it's done deliberately and specifically to try and make money for the employer, then that's absolutely wage theft. Mm-hmm. If it's just, we just screwed up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's not wage theft. It's just underpayment, right? And I think when we try and make these terms so incendiary and so... clickbaity and reality TV-ish, to use your term from earlier, it just makes a huge, huge difference. And I think it's something to be just really thought about carefully. Can I read you something?
Yes.
I've been reading Poor Charlie's Almanac recently, which is the book of kind of some Charlie Munger speeches.
Reread that. Yeah, what a great book.
It is just brilliant. He talks about misery in one of his talks, which sounds badly enough and bad enough, and it kind of is. But he basically talks about the fact that you can't solve for everything. If you do solve for everything, then you can actually create some, to your point before, unintended consequences. So I'm just going to read this this piece. I don't necessarily agree with it entirely, but I can't find myself disagreeing with it. And I guess you've got to come down on one side or the other. But here it is. This quote. Take the workers' Take the workers' compensation system in California. Stress is real, and its misery can be real. So you want to compensate people for their stress in the workplace. It seems like a noble thing to do. But the trouble with such a compensation practice is that it's practically impossible to delete huge cheating. And once you reward cheating, you get crooked lawyers, crooked doctors, crooked unions, etc., participating in referral schemes. You get a total miasma of disastrous behavior. And the behavior makes all the people doing it worse as they do it. So you were trying to help civilization, but what you did was create enormous damage net. So it's much better to let some things go uncompensated, to let life be hard, than to create systems that are easy to cheat.
Love that.
And it's hard, right? Like, because the point is, do you or don't you have a workers' compensation scheme? And frankly, you mentioned NDIS. I remember this when I was tweeting about it only today, for exactly the same reason. You created this system that makes it really, really, really easy to cheat. Now, Munger then goes to give an example of a friend who made a product in Texas. He moved it to Utah, where the Mormons were, mm-hmm. and his workers' compensation expense went from, I'm trying to find it really quick as I scroll here, about 10%, give or take, down to 2% when it moved from state to state. And was it any more safe? Maybe. Let's assume, you know, there might be some element of that. But more broadly, that very idea of, you know, once you remove the culture of that, then the prevalence of it starts to fall. So what do? Do you do workers' compensation? Probably. Well, maybe not. And again, it's not just about workers' comp in Charlie's example, but to your point about what rules do you put in place and what do you try and stop and what are the unintended consequences, it's really, really, really... There is no perfect answer, right? And you will have people at either end of the spectrum yelling at each other and they want their thing. I don't care how much it costs, the worker should be protected. Yeah. Well, I can't afford to pay that. I can't employ people, so I need not to have it. I don't know. I don't know how you do it. I will just see the NDIS for a second. It is an absolute debacle of a structure where cheating, gold plating, raw teasing is absolutely incentivized for a dozen different reasons. And so this is the sort of outcome you get, not because you shouldn't look after people with disability, but because if you structure it incorrectly, once you mm-hmm. and Charlie's point, he says, this sort of tragedy is caused by letting the slop run. You must stop slop early. It's very hard to stop slop and moral failure if you let it run for a while.
Isn't that true?
It's fascinating.
One of the things I picked up there, and I think is a difficult truth to really internalize, but it's one that we need to internalize. Whether it's these kinds of things or just investing and economies in general, is that, we're apes on a rock hurtling through space in an uncaring, random, chaotic universe. And we like to think that everything, we can control everything. And we can't, right? We just can't. There is always going to be bad things that happen in the world. Mm. And does that mean that you just throw your hands in the air and go, oh, well, it's just how it is, you know? We should have a purge every 12 months or, you know, something like that. I'm not saying that, but...
Yeah.
But in an attempt to control what in many cases is uncontrollable, we end up making the situation worse.
Yeah,
you know, and you get some really, really bad outcomes. I'm not trying to dovetail into this, but I think in trying to protect homeowners, for example, and certain investments in that class, we pervert markets and make bigger problems down the track. Mm. And it's just like, well, the reality is investing in anything is going to contain risk. Oh, but that's not fair because families are working hard and they're doing this to sort of better their future. And it's like, but there's risk in that. And that will always be the case. You can't get rid of risk. Oh, there's a massive downturn in the economy, the government should come in and stimulate that and fix that. It's like, okay, well, they can try. They can put a thumb into the dam wall and stop that little leak there. But does that fix the problem or does that make a bigger problem down the track? Mm. And I just feel as though, I guess I'll make this more about the investment side of things, is that we need to really just understand that poo happens, to use the appropriate language. and it always will. And that's the reality of it. And so plan accordingly, because you won't always be bailed out. You can't always be bailed out. You can't legislate to protect things that nothing bad will ever happen to you, because things will. And you know what? Life is unfair. The economy is brutally unfair. Yeah. The systems that we have of all kinds of, unfairness sort of built into them, and let's strive to make it better, but understanding that we will never get rid of all the wrinkles. Like that, you know, am I being too?
No, you want to have slightly different ideological perspectives on how much involvement and what's worth doing, not worth doing, and what side effects you're prepared to accept. But it's the right question, right? It's absolutely the right question of, you know, if too much medicine can kill a patient as much as not enough, right? There is a balance to be found. You and I may never agree on what exactly that balance is, but conceptually, we're both in agreement that you need to be very, very careful about those unintended consequences.
100%.
They can be really ugly.
Mate, we are dealing with stuff today in 2024 that you can trace the origins back to the GFC.
Yes.
And you can trace that back to the tech wreck of early 2000.
Yep.
And you can trace that back to some of the stimulatory efforts that came out of the mid-90s recession. They're like, mm-hmm. you know, as as they say, history is just one damn thing after another.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's these things are always, bailouts and all of this stuff are always done, at least with the veneer of wanting to do the right thing. It's yeah. just funny that it's the mega rich bankers that get bailed out. But anyway, that's a whole other kettle of fish. But I get pretty firm on the view that I'm with, speaking of Charlie, I'm very much with Charlie that, you know, capitalism without failure is like Christianity without hell. You kind of have to have it, right? Oh, that's really brutal and unfair and people could lose their jobs and their businesses. Like, yeah, but what's the alternative, right? The threat of failure really sharpens the mind. You know, really makes people focus on the downside, not just the upside. Will there be misery and suffering? Yeah, there will be as a consequence of that. But as a society, I think we are better served. We are more robust. And here's the other reality is like, well, try and fix it because you can't. Because by trying to fix it, you just create a much, much, much bigger problem down the track and much, much, much more pain. So it's sort of, that's why I'm sort of saying we have to acknowledge that there are just some really nasty things that can happen in life and business and markets. And an attempt to fix them can usually in time make it a lot worse. And you know, the rise of populism and all kinds of really nasty things happen in the wake of that. And I think we're living through very interesting times as a consequence of these things. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. I only for the sake of completeness, I agree with the risks. I think they can be ameliorated with sensible, proactive, responsible government. And I think probably, you know, the story of the last 30, 40 years can be rewritten differently with different actions taken at different times. Yes, partly with the benefit of hindsight, partly, frankly, just with the benefit of common sense. When populist politics and other things take over or hard decisions are ducked, you know, there's a range of, I won't go any further, it doesn't matter, but there's a range of outcomes, pressures, actions, and those things in combination can, as you say, magnify things or ameliorate things. Mm. You just got to be careful you choose the right one; otherwise, they can get meaningfully out of control.
Yep.
You will desperately want to say right now that, you know, the property market in Australia is part of that story, right? The idea of that solving affordability by throwing more money at it every time,
yeah,
just makes the fire bigger rather than smaller. And it's not that people shouldn't be able to afford homes; it's just working out how to manage that. A benevolent dictator makes different decisions, mm-hmm. and different policy tools are more effective in the hands of such a person, as opposed to people with other incentives. To speak of Charlie, always follow the money, or just the broad incentives, not necessarily for monetary, but the broad incentives absolutely matter.
Yeah, they do, and yeah, again, it's just there's no easy answers for this stuff, and bad stuff happens, and it sounds really uncaring. I don't mean it to be, but it's just that is always going to be the case, and there's
We're in a world where it's same with unemployment, interest rates, and inflation, right?
Yes,
the RBA knows that cooling inflation means slowing demand means more people out of work.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Faustian bargain. There is no third option. Now, to your point, you would say, well, don't do anything, and that's fine too. But there is no solution where everybody's happy all the time.
No.
Which, by the way, why safety nets are important, where you just say, hey, for capitalism to roughly work pretty well for most of the people most of the time, some of the people are going to lose from that system. And you say, okay, well, let's try and make it as painless or as little pain as possible for those who do lose because of a structure we impose on them. Totally appropriate. The people who say, well, let's change systems, then it's like, okay, well, show me the better system. Show me one that works better for everybody. And that's where it falls down. It's like, well, this sucks. Yes, it really does.
Mm-hmm.
We should have something better. Yes, we should. And when you find it, let me know. Until then, everything else we've tried so far is worse. So just care for what you wish for. Mm-hmm. This is the least worst outcome. That's, as you say, mate, we're apes on a rock. I love the, you've not expressed it that way before. We have to deal, it's not quite laws of nature, but it's not far off, right? There are realities to the way our world works that creates outcomes, good outcomes or bad outcomes, because that's just there is no, you know, what is it, every action is an equal opposite, it just is, right? It just is.
Mm-hmm.
And so you got to say, right, let's find the least worst system, and then let's ameliorate, because we're nice people, let's ameliorate the pain for those who aren't going to win, But that's the best we can do. Net, as running a system, that's how you do it, right? There is no perfect, oh, let's just make it, if the economists were right, it'd be great. You put all everything in the efficient markets, would be fantastic. You put all this in a formula, the formula works, and therefore, A equals MC squared. Oh, great. Secrets of the universe uncovered. We can fix the economy now. It just doesn't work that way, because it's not a physical system in the same way that science or maths is
it's really not. It's really not. I mean, and here's the other thing as well, is that we're not a closed system in this country. Yes. Now, we are 2% of global GDP. We punch above our weight population-wise, right? Well, you know, go Australia. But we're a tadpole in an ocean.
Yeah, we are.
And you know, even with the best policy and, you know, we are a sock in the wind as to what policy decisions may be made in the US or China or Europe. And there's just absolutely nothing that you can do about those kinds of things. And so it's just a recognition, I think, of reality and what do you do about it.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is.
And I think what you do, well, for me, I'm very big, and we've talked about it a lot, I'm very big on the idea of prepare, don't predict. And it's just about, you know, chipmunks put nuts away when they're plentiful. They bury them all over the place. They prepare for the future. A lot of them won't be dug up again, but they're there if they're needed. And I think in our just-in-time world, and you know, I expect, you know, a theater room in every house and a heated swimming pool and spa. It's just like we live right to the edge of what we're able to do, and then we cry foul when something goes wrong because we've got no slack in that we have provided for ourselves. And then we shout at the politicians that, you know, you need to fix it for me. And it feels like, and I think as a parent, you get it more, right? It's just like, I would love for my kids just to have McDonald's Sundays, you know, morning, noon. They would love it too. Kids, we're having Maccas every single day, morning, noon and night. Yep. You can sit in front of a screen, do what you like. And they would love it. You know, I would be, if they got to vote on their parents, I would be reelected, you know, every day. Yeah. I'm probably not doing those kids any favors by doing that. They're just like, well, there's just consequences. Like, life isn't like that. You know, that's really unfair. Like, yep, that's the crushing reality that dawns on you as you age, and the weight of the world crushes your spirit and your will to live. Maybe this is just my middle-aged angst and midlife crisis, sort of speaking. But it's sort of like, it's just how it is.
Yeah, exactly. Mate, we're going long, but I'm gonna keep you for another 10 minutes because the other thing we need to cover this week is the competition review done by Alan Fels.
Oh, yes.
Which is a massive topic. We're not going to do it anywhere near
10 minutes.
Justice, mate, without spending another hour on it. But so the most fascinating thing for me so far on this one is the ACTU, we all know that's the Australian Council of Trade Unions, asked the former ACCC chair, Alan Fels, to do an inquiry into competition in Australia and price gouging in particular. The union wants it, Fels does it. Okay, so you kind of imagine. They released the report on Thursday morning, and the first full-throated support was from David Littleproud, the Nationals leader. That was not on my 2024 bingo card. It is a hell of a thing when
speaking of populist,
right? Oh, the unions and Littleproud are in the same story. So that was interesting. And what really sucks, and you and I both do some work with the media, some really good people in the media, we've talked about that. There's a lot of unfortunate headline grabbing with the phrase price gouging appearing a lot. And it's notable that Fels almost never says price gouging. And, you know, he says other people are overcharging, so the media grab it. You want a headline, Woolworths overcharging or Qantas price gouging, whatever you want to go with it. But so I kind of looked and went, I'm so kind of sick of it. What I did do, though, was I kind of went, well, actually, I want to see what Fels actually says. And I'm just going to read a couple of these things, mate, and get some general thoughts. There's a lot of stuff in that massive report. We're not going to do it justice. We can do a whole podcast on it, so I'll do it justice. So the least useful, in my opinion, is his first recommendation, where he says, establish a National Competition and Prices Commission, which has a standing review of the market and examines the reasons behind high prices. Now he says it wouldn't replace the ACCC, it would take some pressure off the regulator. without a so what, without a this is what it's going to do, without a, you know, really, so wheat's expensive or there's not enough competition in airlines, I don't really, it may function to put some pressure on politicians to make some changes to competition law or something else. So there might be kind of a tangential benefit. This is, that's not the one I loved.
No. That's the point we were just making there, right?
Exactly.
Well intentioned, but yeah. Sometimes prices of wheat is just going to go up, and there's not like someone twiddling their evil moustache there behind it all. It's a consequence of very real supply demand dynamics in a market in a global and ruthless market at that.
And by the way, if you ask a former regulator what you should do, you're probably going to get regulated as the answer.
Yes.
But for all of that, I actually really loved almost all of the rest of it. So. I'll read each one and get your thoughts. Next one was strengthen competition law. So this is fascinating. So he wants to strengthen the competition law by boosting the provisions of the merger test to stop more potentially anti-competitive mergers. He wants to reverse the onus of proof in merger cases so that the merged entities have to prove it's good rather than the ACCC having to prove it's bad.
Yes, like that.
Introducing a law that means big businesses found to have breached competition law can be broken up. And revive the national competition policy the government is currently preparing, as well as shortening the competition provisions, which are currently about 20,000 words long. That sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Happy with all that or got issues?
I mean, I very, very strongly believe that the antidote to high prices is more competition. very fundamentally. I really believe that. And where you get... The more market power you have, the more you trend to a monopoly status, the more potential there is for gouging and unscrupulous behavior.
Yes.
The trouble I have, the hesitation I have is where you draw the line. It's very tricky. So let's look at Bezos, right? And Amazon. I mean, have they created value for the world? Well, yeah, I can get something delivered in a day and probably less than that in the not too distant future. Mm. And I pay hardly any prices for that. I don't pay a very high price for that. It's like, I think all of us are better off because of that. And you think, well, that is a consequence of very, very large scale. Mm-hmm. And you think, okay, but if we now look around and go, well, you've got too much power, we're going to break you up. It's like, okay, that seems good, but then there are going to be costs to that at the same time. So I'm speaking intentionally out of two sides of my mouth here because I don't know where that philosophically I'm with you, right? But I don't know where you draw the line.
So I will say quickly, mate, in this piece, he's not saying we should break up dominant players. He's saying you break them up if they're found to breach competition law.
Okay.
So it's almost your argument before about the employer who does the wrong thing and goes to jail because he did the wrong thing and done after the fact.
Yeah.
This is kind of one of those ones where it's like, if you've done the wrong thing, if you've breached competition law, the implications for that business is, well, guys, you did the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Here's the not your Amazon probably is doing bad things, I suppose, just because.
Oh, I wanted to add that actually. I'm not a fan of some of their workplace practices.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
But if they're not breaching competition law under this rule, they wouldn't be broken up. It'd only be in cases where they've breached competition law, they've done the wrong cartel behavior or whatever else they've done that's breached. Then you can be broken up as a consequence, which I actually don't mind. I think it's gonna, if as long as you know the rules up front, you play by the rules. There's costs, there's fines, there's whatever. Breakup seems like a not unreasonable antidote to a deliberate breach of the law.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I feel as though if you or I were the only two board members of Amazon, right, and our job is very, very specifically to maximize shareholder wealth.
Yeah.
And you look at your business and the competitive advantages you have, you say, we should use our market power. Why Correct. Wouldn't we use our Correct. Market
yes.
power? That what is the point of being the king if you don't get the privileges of being the king at the same time? So it's sort of like we can do this. We've almost got a duty in a certain way to do it.
But that's not breaking the law though, right? That's what I'm saying. There's a difference between using market power and breaking the law. That's I'm putting a very hard line. I'm okay with anyone using their market power up to the point at which time it contravenes a law.
Well, you still got to set the line, though. Where's the line? And there's so
but as long as it's known in advance, I mean, if you steal something, you go to jail.
Okay.
You break competition law.
Oh yeah. Some element. Yeah.
I don't know. The next one, mate, was... Yep. Okay, go on.
No. You've given me... I think I agree with you. Yep. Next one.
No, so I wasn't trying to beat you.
We're doing this live, right? I'm forming opinions in real time here.
I like it. Increased banking portability. Force banks to 100%. Make accounts fully portable.
Yes.
So customers can switch banks in the same way they can switch telcos and retain their same phone numbers. Follow the regulator's advice and make banks more transparent, comparable, and proactive in how they alert customers and the public about changes in deposit and bonus rates.
Yep. Can I just say, though?
Yeah, please.
It's not happening.
No, it's
not. No way. Like, I don't want to say anything that I'm going to later regret. So I'll just go with the usual. I'll eat my hat if that happens. No chance.
My only issue with this, mate, is if you're a commercial business, if you're a bank, and you have your views on the banks. I have my views on the banks, but. Mm-hmm. So let's make it about the banks. Let's try and leave some baggage at the door. You've got your commercial, but you built a brand, you built a business, everything else. When you say to a bank customer, you know, other businesses have, you love trapdoor moats, right? Your idea of like how is it to move from, you know, this ERP to that ERP. If you made every enterprise resource planning system interoperable, so customers could just move their data at a moment's notice. You did the same with cloud accounting. You did the same with every other part of our lives. I don't think we'd think it was necessarily fair. And frankly, I don't actually know what it does to capitalism at some point when you effectively make every business a commodity because everything can be moved at a moment's notice.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know any bank shares, so I've got no dog in the fight. But I don't know. At some point, you know, at least with the telcos, there's a different network, right? There's a different... you move from the opposite network to the Telstra network or whatever. You're getting something different. You can take your number with you. But there's, you know, you're signing up for something different. You're paying a different amount based on different fees and charges or benefits or whatever. I don't know. It makes me a little uncomfortable that we're saying we're stripping your competitive advantage, your competitive benefits, with no compensation justification. Not justification. There's reasons to do it. I know it just strikes me a little bit draconian. To say we're stripping away that competitive advantage and saying to you, bad luck, now deal with it. And whatever it does to your profit margins, because your customers can move to very easily, X years, centuries after banking started, we're now changing this one rule. These are multi-billion dollar businesses. That to me feels a little bit, I don't know how, I like people being able to move easily. Full portability where you just kind of press the button and go, oh, I'm now an ANZ customer, oh, now a NAB customer, oh, now a CBA customer. I don't know what it does. I don't know how reasonable it is in a capitalist society to remove some of those competitive moats, advantages, castle walls, whatever you want to use. I don't know.
Yeah, it is a really hard one. I mean, my view is that world is coming anyway.
Right.
You know, be your own bank. Let's not go there. But
thank you.
But I do think there is, while that is, your comments are generally true for other industries, I think banks enjoy a very privileged position within our society. I mean, they are the gatekeepers of money, like the oil of the economy. It is such a systemically important industry.
Yes.
And it is one in this country, at least, that is hyper-concentrated. That I feel as though, and it's also one that is pretty profitable too, and more profitable on a margin. I'm just talking, you know, make up, say, large billion-dollar number and go, that's bad. I just mean, you know, in terms of margins, they tend to do pretty well compared to other international peers. I think anything that can remove frictions, and therefore you now need to compete much more with each other.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, people are going to leave and they're just going to press a button and leave. Now, at the moment, you can do that. I can switch from CBA to Westpac and there's nothing stopping me to do that, except I need to go into a branch and open this up and do this and then, and then contact all of... It's a nightmare. And you just go, it sucks, but I can't be bothered. Yeah. And they know that. And they know that. So I actually am in favor of portability for banks. But you're right. It's a slippery slope. Where do you draw the line?
It's also so that he also made comments about supermarkets. He basically said the government should keep going with the review they've already announced, which is fine. Also, make the grocery code of conduct mandatory and legally enforceable. I want to add that, and I want to talk about that and the banks at the same time, mate, because my only other thought with both those industries, bank margins are already under 2%.
Mm.
Supermarket margins are probably 5-ish percent. I don't know who we think pays the bills in some either of these cases. You know, if the banks compete harder against each other, maybe we all save a tenth of 1% or something. There's not that much room in their margins for, you know, for savings. Same with the supermarkets. Like, well, what do we kind of think is going to happen? So part of me thinks, yeah, that, you know, more competition is good. I think that's always the case. So I'm not even saying but or in, except. Or more competition is absolutely good in any of these cases. But at some point, given the, you made the point before about the national network and you pay something for that. We pay, I've never really thought about supermarket margins this way before. But effectively, we get food for 99% of us, whatever it is. There's a supermarket within a certain drive. So we get the benefits of a supermarket, and we take it for granted, but think about what that is. And we only have to pay 5% above cost to get that. Is that not the best deal in the world? you're paying a dollar for 95 cents worth of cost. So all I've got to pay is an extra 5%. I get like a supermarket, and it's like 5 minutes away, and everything's there, and it's cold, and it's fresh, and it's reviewed, and it's staffed, and I pay 5% more than cost for that. Mm. That's brilliant.
Mm.
You know, and so I just kind of think with those guys in the banks, part of me just thinks, what are we kind of intellectually or sometimes even just, you know, we kind of want it because we want it. We kind of want to have a win and we want to stick it to the bastards and all that kind of stuff. I don't know. I'm not entirely sure what we think we're getting out of it. Maybe margins go down a tiny, tiny amount. Does it matter in the overall scheme of things? Probably not. Is it all sound of fury for nothing? I don't know. I'm not sure. It's not too close, mate. Are all the things we can, and we'll get to energy in a second, for the other things we can look at, is the pot at the end of the rainbow? I don't know. It's massive.
Yeah, it's a degree. It's a question of degrees. Yeah. You know, like, and this is the thing with fund managers know this very well, right? So they'll go and say, yeah, well, it's only a 2% fee. You know, that's hardly egregious. Like, yeah. Well, except it kind of is, given that when you're managing, you know, $500 billion, you cover your costs and then some, and and to such a significant degree. So it's sort of, I absolutely get your point, and I think you're right, but it is about setting the framework in place that ensures that competition will do its thing the most efficient way kind of possible. So is it great? You know, these aren't like ultra obscene levels of you know, taking advantage of whatever market power you have. Yeah. They're not, but it could probably be better. Right. And I'm going to work harder and to offer value for my customers if I know that they can leave much easier. So I'm still be profitable, right? I have to be, because otherwise the whole system fails. And at a point, each competitor is eyeing the other going, well, I'll go as close as I can to the bottom end of what's possible as a margin, but no further, because then I'm not viable. Mm-hmm. But it drives me in that direction, where at the moment I can probably sit a decent distance away from that just because I can. So it's hard.
It is, mate. Energy. So this is interesting. I completely agree with him. I've got to say it. His first suggestion, I get no context for, so I can't even have a view on this. Review the wholesale energy market, which makes sense, to see whether it should be redesigned or switched to a system of capacity market, like in the US and Western Australia. I have no idea what that means. So I'm not going to, other than we should be review the wholesale energy market. Yes, absolutely. This is interesting though. Give ASIC, the Australian Securities Investments Commission, a direction to investigate the energy derivatives market to ensure players are not misusing their positions. I have a suspicion. You know what's interesting, mate? This is where you kind of go private versus public provision of that kind of stuff.
Mm.
In the past, governments would have absorbed the swings on raw material price. Right? When coal price went up and down, the government didn't need to make a profit every year. And so they just kind of absorbed the impact, right? So the energy price were reasonably flat and stable, even though the price of oil or coal might have fluctuated. Excuse me. A little bit like the RBA making money on their you know, currency. It would have fluctuated within public hands. Now, in theory, you'd hope they would have covered the costs over time, and you know, but there's a straight line, right? And the zigzag above and below it. They make some money and make a lot of money some years, make massive loss another year, kind of nets out.
Mm.
So while Fell's talking about the, you know, checking the derivatives market, which I'm sure derivatives, by the way, is energy futures, right? So basically the companies bet on what the price might be. I'm not entirely sure we haven't just created, like all those other artificial markets, a way for the investment bankers to skim a bit of money off the top. Think about this, the NDIS, think about water rights. What else am I missing? There's a million of the ETS, emissions trading scheme, carbon credits.
Oh, yeah.
You know, all these things are just artificial markets created in theory because people believe that markets are best. And often, as we've just said, they are. Just not always. I don't know. Energy derivatives market, enough? The right idea?
Look, I mean, I once many years ago tried to look into that and I'm just not smart enough. That is, yeah. Gosh, that is so complicated. But it is, same with options and futures, right? Like they're just degenerate gambling for the most part.
Yes, correct. Correct.
But
dressed up in nice suits, yeah.
You know, but that started for very good reasons because farmers wanted to hedge away some of their. I'm going to grow a crop. I don't know how much I'm going to grow. I don't know what the price of wheat is going to be. I will take a contract and I will hedge that. It means I lose any potential upside beyond that point, but at least I can operate with some certainty. And there'll be someone on the other side of that trade who's happy to sort of take that bet, and that's a good thing. And they're not speculating on the price of wheat. The farmer, they're doing that because they're trying to lock in certainty, and the market has created a product that helps them do that. And I think I'm actually very open to that. I think people who use those contracts are doing so for very sensible reasons. And I think that's probably the same when you look at a retailer who has to deal with a lot of fluctuations in demand and supply and all of this stuff. It's like, we're not gambling here. We're trying to very sensibly hedge our exposure and give the business a little bit of certainty. But there's a big spectrum of that very sort of reasonable standpoint through to, no, I'm just taking a punt because I can and I'm on a trading desk and I'm going to try and make some money. Where's the line drawn? I don't know. I don't know.
Same thing. Yeah. Same thing. Let's try and get these other ones pretty quickly. Stop paying more for electric vehicles. I don't know. This feels like a bit of a sop to the kind of cool kids, but apparently there's a restriction on parallel importation of electric vehicles, and apparently we might be able to buy them 10 grand cheaper if we didn't do that, and it benefit the environment. I don't really know the context of that one. Seems like if it's unnecessary, it's unnecessary. I assume there might be reasons to ban parallel importation of EVs, but I don't know what it would be.
Yeah.
I'll take Fels' word on that one.
I don't know enough about it, yeah.
Keep a close eye on early childhood education and care. Give the competition regulator the power. This is by another artificial market that's been screwed up. Give the competition regulator the power to investigate pricing decisions made by the for-profit providers to ensure they're not involved in gaming the system. Have the competition regulator continuously review pricing in disability care, disability support, and aged care. Kind of gets to the NDIS thing. I think that's pretty self-explanatory.
Yep.
This one was fascinating. Regulate airport prices the same way other utility prices are regulated. Take advantage of the existing aviation review by removing international and domestic restrictions on competition, reviewing your remaining restrictions under the Treasury-led competition policy review. So basically, set airport prices and remove any restrictions on other airlines flying to and from Australia and around the country. That's big. For the something that comes at the end, we've had massive restrictions on domestic and international airlines for years and years and years. The government basically hands out slots. We had the Qatar Airways thing not long ago. This would take all that away if Fels gets what he wants. Seems pretty reasonable to me.
Yeah. I think so too, yeah. Yeah, well, I mean,
airport infrastructure is interesting.
Anything that has a natural monopoly is... Yeah. I'm more for regulation the closer we get to that end of the spectrum.
Yep.
We've said before, it just does not make sense for me to have 12 different companies providing, you know, electricity to my house. I mean, it is in power lines, infrastructure, because then the streets are just covered in wires. It doesn't make sense for us to have four airports next to each other to foster competition. They are natural kind of monopolies. And so, yeah, I think that in this instance, it seems reasonable.
Last one is studying medical specialist fees, which is pretty much all he said. Just do it. I assume there's an expectation that maybe there's some profiteering or collusion in specialist fees. I don't know. I don't know the context there, but that would be probably worth doing, I would assume.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, I'm just going to make some ill-formed comment. I can't fault the intention, but I'm not close enough to it to know whether there is a problem that needs fixing or not. Mm. I don't know.
But apparently the ACTU and the Nationals agree. So that's that either means they've got it absolutely right or God help all of us. I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, I don't know what that means. But, yeah.
There you go. Mate, we are. This is the longest podcast by a decent margin. We will wrap it up here. Fools, thank you for listening. Thanks for spending a bit of time with us. Hopefully it was interesting. There's so much happening this week, and hopefully we got through a decent chunk of it and gave you some thoughts and some ideas. I haven't publicized the socials for all that occurred to me during the week. So follow Andrew on Twitter at @Sage_Simeon and at @StrawmanInvest. Go to strawman.com as well, of course. You can follow me on all of the socials other than Facebook at @TMFScottP. On Facebook, I'm /ScottPhillipsMoney. Until next week, until Sunday, actually, I should say. You come back Sunday?
You know it.
Good. Full on.
Cheers.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.